Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a fine slice of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we catch up again with leading mask theatre company Vamos as they tour their thought-provoking new show Dead Good, and we speak to the founder and director of Black Voices as they tour and inspire a celebration of the black oral music traditions. You can find more information, get in touch, and links to our full archive at www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with an extended conversation with Rachel Savage, Artistic Director of Vamos Theatre, who through their latest production explore death, dying and end of life. This life-affirming piece is currently on tour and considers thoughts and attitudes to death through the lens of mask theatre. Listeners should note that the discussion is very open and takes in many of the issues explored in this creative and frank production. So I'm very pleased to be again with Rachel Savage, who's the Artistic Director of Vamos Theatre here in the Worcester Arts Workshop.
Yep, that's our home.
Where we are, yeah. Which is a labyrinth, I have to say,
yes,
of creativity. There are things everywhere,
yeah.
Not just printers and radiators, but interesting things as well.
Well, there's masks on the wall. They're all staring at you. I don't notice them, but people who walk in who haven't been here before do get a little bit...
It's like they're kind of watching
alarmed.
You.
They are.
So yeah,
watch okay. What you say.
So let's. We met, I think, probably over a year ago now.
Yep.
When you were working on Finding Joy.
Yep.
Which was, I think, one of the sort of your last big productions. You know, did lots of different things. And you've got an exciting new production that we're going to talk about. But let's, before we start talking about that, let's talk about Vamos, and let's talk about what we call mask theatre. So
yeah.
Folks listening might be a little bit baffled by that. So let's just explain that to start with.
Yeah, it's something that's really difficult to explain on the radio, isn't it?
It is a bit.
The genres are completely and utterly different. So whereas your world is full of words,
yes,
and pause and pace and tone and emphasis of words, our world doesn't have any words.
It's completely unspoken, isn't it?
All visual. Apart from, we also then work with a composer, so all of the work is underlined with a live score, if you like. So full mask theatre means that the actors don't speak. It means that they've got beautifully crafted masks on their faces that have been made by Russell Dean of Strange Face Theatre Company. We almost have our own language, which means that we can tour all over the world. So we tour everywhere from China to Finland to France to Norway, because we have one common language, which is the language of the non-verbal.
So it makes it very accessible.
Utterly accessible.
And very human, I think, as well. Although yep. They're not caricatures. I wouldn't describe them as that. They're very recognisable kind of faces.
Yeah, know? The style that Russell used to make them in used to be far more cartoony, and I've come back to him because of the themes of the show that I'm interested in working on. I've gone back and said, can they be more realistic and can they be more recognisable? So when a character comes on stage, somebody might go, oh, that looks just like my granddad, or oh, I saw them last week in the co-op. They're very, very recognisable faces. And people also watch and think, those faces have moved, those masks have moved, and yet they don't, because they're pieces of plastic. And so what my job is with the actors, is translating essentially a much researched theme and story and script that I write, then into full mask theatre. And what that means is that an actor has an internal monologue, so they have a script going on inside their head, but without speaking, they have to make sure that that script ends up into every single audience member's mind, which is why the audience come in at the beginning, particularly people who haven't seen our shows before. So for the first 2 minutes, there's usually silence when people are thinking, oh, what have I come to see? Why was I dragged along to see this? And then within 2 minutes, they start laughing because they understand. And then the roller coaster begins of real heartfelt laughter, and then we pull people in to feel the also all those other different emotions that in our lives that we go through.
So it's interesting thinking about a script in terms of something that's very much based on body language.
Yep.
And lighting, I guess. You know, lighting plays a part in this, as well as the music you mentioned. But
lighting's key, sound is key. Projection we use a lot, and film in this one. So costumes, set design, everything that is visual, apart from the music, is the way in which we storytell.
The other thing to me is that, having been to one of the performances previously, it's very readily, you kind of, it's almost like you're in the scene.
You know what I mean? Because it's very sort of, not in your face, but it's very sort of, you know, there's a real interaction with it.
So we pull you in. Yeah. So some companies who do mass theatre, it's really, it's almost farcical and they reach out to you. And for me, it's far too over the top. And it's absolutely a style of mass theatre that I'm not interested in. I'm more interested in very naturalistic. As I say, pulling the audience in, you know, we meet our audience halfway. And the audience's job is to interpret. And so that's why you're feeling so involved, because you are pulled in. You know, I was laughing with our accountant yesterday who came to see Finding Joy years ago. And when he came out, he'd never seen any of our shows, he was sobbing. And he just went, I don't know what you've done to me. I don't know why I'm feeling like this. And I kind of went, well, Jeff, I do. Because what you've done is you've really invested and you've met us halfway. You've had to interpret exactly what people are thinking and feeling. And in doing that, you start to sympathise and then you start to empathise. And that's when you can make people think, because you've made them feel. So we have we get hold of their brains, we then have a fast track down to their hearts, we make them feel, and then that's how we make people think, which is why I believe it's a really powerful genre in order to take on powerful subjects.
And I think it does make really deep connections, you know, kind of, I guess it taps into the wiring of, you know, how you think and feel about things, which I think is very powerful for theatre.
Yeah, and all our shows at the end of the day are about the most genuine, truthful, honest human connections, which I think we need to keep striving for in the present circumstances in the world, and in the world of social media, and in the world of, you know, where we start to lose that kind of human connection, human touch, face-to-face contact. So whether our shows, say, for example, you talked about Finding Joy was about living with dementia. We've done a show about forced adoption in the 1960s. Our last show was actually about post-traumatic stress in the military. This show is about end of life. So all of the stories are about themes that are very close to my heart, and they are stories that need to be told. And they're usually giving a voice to somebody who doesn't have a voice, all without words, which is why, you know, we have people saying, I've been to see all your shows, but my husband would never come. And this time I eventually managed to bring him along. And he's always said, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about this company for? I just don't get it. How can that work? And then they come along and go, ah, I get it. It's seeing is believing.
So let's talk about the new production, which is called Dead Good.
Yep.
And the strap line for it really is quite clever, because it's you start at the end. I think that's how you describe it.
Yeah.
And essentially we're talking about death, and I guess the process of dying and coming to terms with that process.
Yeah. It's a weird one, isn't it? Why would you want to make a piece of theatre about that? And why is it selling out everywhere we go? So why on Wednesday night were there 700 people at Malvern Theatres, and at this one theatre 10 days earlier it was sold out, and in London it sold out? So I think it's selling out because of the reputation of the company, but also because people are probably interested in the taboo subject that we're talking about. And essentially what people have come to me afterwards and are saying in all of our feedback is that it's life-affirming and that it's a celebration of life. And, oh, now I understand dying better, and I understand the process of dying better. And one woman came to me the other night and said, my husband died 2 years ago. No, 2 months ago. And I said, oh my, you know, why have you come tonight? And she said, because I've seen you work and I wanted to see it. And she said, it's made me feel more positive, because it made me think I did things right and his death was really good. And it's, oh God, what a weird thing to say. And I don't have a good relationship with death, and I live in utter fear of it. So when a fan of our shows came to see our show, has been to see all our shows, and she emailed me and said, I want to talk about a potential theme for your next show being about end of life, I went into that meeting thinking, there's no way I'm going to get involved in this, because I live in so much fear and dread of it. Having lost my best mate when we were both 27, I don't want to talk about it. I live a life worthy of two people to try and make the life of my mates worthwhile, or the death of him. I'm an overprotective mother. You know, all of those things that make you go, yeah, I'm scared of death. And actually, it was Dr. Maggie Keeble that came to that meeting with me, and she talked so much sense about the way in which we don't discuss it, and actually how it can empower people, and it can make the grieving process better, and it can make the family hold together in a far better way, and actually how we don't need to live in fear of death. And we've taken away the conversation of dying. And this, as even as I'm speaking, I'm thinking about people who have got life-limiting illnesses or are the loved one of somebody with life-limiting illnesses. And everything that falls out of my mouth, it feels like madness. And yet what we've done is I've worked in hospices and I've brought a core belief, nothing about us without us, is very close to my heart. And so we've brought people who are terminally ill into the rehearsal process, into the script writing process. Every stage on the way, I have made friends and built up trust and been just in awe of how much I have to learn from people who are dying.
And I think one thing that strikes me very much about your approach to this and this production is you have definitely done your homework in the sense that, you know, you have involved, you know, palliative care professionals, those support groups, people have been through some fairly tough times. And I think there are other sort of productions or creative processes that attempt to kind of have that dialogue around dying and death, and they kind of miss the mark because they're kind of saying, ah, oh, don't worry about it, really, it's going to happen. But actually what you're saying is that it's considering it as sort of, I guess, a reflective process as part of life itself.
It's the only thing we all have in common, apart from being born. We're all going to die. I'd have never said that 2 years ago on the radio. And actually within that, can we take control of that? You know, we all have birthing plans that sometimes absolutely go down the drain. My first birthing plan was chucked out. But we only have one chance to die. And so if we put more time and thought and energy into how we want to die, then maybe it could be a better process. And the whole show, I'd say that 80% of the show is about living. And that's what people who are terminally ill have taught me to do better. They've taught me to live better. They've taught me to appreciate the minutiae in life. You know, I have now brilliant, brilliant close friends. Nick Moss, who's come on board. He's been a consultant all his life. And now as a patient at St. Richard's Hospice, he's been the script consultant on this show. And he's taught me to look at the sky differently. You know, I look at the sky today and it's blue and it's the sun shining. And I might not have noticed that. And then another great friend, Dave, he's told me to appreciate the rain. He doesn't worry or grumble when it's raining anymore. It's brilliant. So I go running now when it's raining. I think, come on, let's go for a run. And there's so something magical about it.
I guess a kind of clarity or a kind of an urgency to a point, I suppose, makes you reconsider things.
Absolutely. I think the feedback that the show is life-affirming, I think. And their involvement of actually working with people who are terminally ill, they've allowed the show to be more comical because humour is key. And humour is absolutely key in their life. And when I talk to people who say, for example, when my mates were coming into the rehearsal room and the actors were going, oh, what do I say? Do I say, hello, how are you? Oh, no, don't ask that question. Don't ask that question, because they'll say, I've got cancer, so don't ask that question. And it's kind of like, and I said to them, their bodies have gone to hell, but their souls and their reason for being is on fire. And so hold on to that. And it's when we have two terminally ill friends in the rehearsal room laughing and taking the mick out of us and kind of ripping us to bits. And it's just hysterical. And it's kind and it's beautiful and it's sometimes dark, but mainly it's not farce. And it's kind of an innocent schoolboy humour that us British seem to get on very, very well with.
Indeed, and at the centre of Dead Good is a friendship. In some ways, an unlikely friendship, but it kind of, I think, for me, sort of tackles potentially the sort of isolation of the process or the acknowledgement of dying.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is sometimes it's not necessarily just people being isolated from their network or their community, but they kind of isolate themselves from their identity because they're not allowed in some ways, or perhaps they feel they're not allowed to be themselves.
Yeah. I think, I mean, personally, I've had a breast cancer scare and a cervix cancer scare, and both of them, you know, the letter comes through the post and it's you open up that envelope with dread, and as soon as you read it, I don't even read it properly. I kind of go into this fearful, mad, dread world of, well, I'm going to be dead in 3 months and I'm going to leave my children without a mother. And I go from 0 to 60 to the worst case scenario. And I think, so what I've learned from Nick and from Dave is that thing again of my body's gone to hell, but how can I look after my mind? And how can I keep living in the most positive way? Meeting and befriending people who are dying have taught me more positivity that I already had. But it's things like when I met Dave, he said he used to be a boss, he used to be difficult to work with, he was not a nice bloke. Prostate cancer comes along, he's been on hormone replacement tablets, and he says those, you know, he used to be difficult to work with, difficult to deal with, not great at showing his emotions, and he said now I cry a lot and I'm touchy and I'm feely and I'm loving, and his ability to love feels like it has multiplied so many times through his living with cancer and living with the knowledge that his life isn't going to go on forever, which none of us are, so we should all live like that.
You're listening to the New Curiosities Box with me, James Sandy. And now to music. Carol Pemberton, MBE, is founder and musical director of Black Voices, an a cappella quintet from Birmingham exploring the black oral musical traditions. Ahead of their gig at Warwick Arts Centre on Saturday the 7th of March, I quizzed Carol on their repertoire and wider mission. So I'm really pleased to be joined by Carol Pemberton of the Black Voices Choir. And Carol, let's start with what that is, because that I think it's deceptive in some ways, because it's not just a choir, is it? It's more of a, I would say, a celebration?
Well, I wouldn't even call this a choir.
Okay.
We're a quintet. We're five women that travel the world singing. We sing in the black oral tradition. I guess a modern, well, not a modern term, because that's an ancient term. It's a Latin word, a cappella, which means according to the chapel. So we rely very much on the resonance of the human voice to fill the places that we sing in. When we're in a large auditorium, we use a PA system. And yeah, we have over 400 songs in our repertoire, so there's a lot to draw on.
Wow. Now, having read about who you are and what you do, there's a notion of the preservation of black oral music traditions.
Yes.
Hopefully I've got that right.
Yes.
Now, that is massive, I think.
So it's not massive, and it's not mind-blowing, actually.
Okay.
I think, like many of our idols, your Chaka Khans, your Stevie Wonders, your Arethas, your Nina, your Whitney, whoever, we grew up in the black church, and that experience allows a freedom of expression that is not within classical music or, you know, any musical form that relies on a score for precision. Yeah?
So I was thinking, it's a thread, isn't it, that runs through so many different strands of music.
Yes.
You know, that kind of black oral tradition.
Yeah.
I was thinking, you know, from sort of, well, even, it doesn't start with Elvis, but, you know, it was there in Elvis, wasn't it? You know, that was there. It's there now in a lot of hip-hop and pop and reggae.
Yeah.
So how do you, in terms of the sort of performances and the programme of things that you put together, how do you sort of distinguish which songs or sounds or traditions that you focus on? Is it that's what I mean, is the kind of, it's massive. It must be hard perhaps to know where to start, or is it...
Okay, well, our repertoire has a bit of everything. We are children of the first generation, the Windrush generation that came here. In the 50s and 60s. So we have all that Caribbean stuff of our parents. We have the classically trained stuff that we all grew up in within school. So as a child, I played cello. I played all the recorders and wind instruments that, you know, you start off with the triangle, whatever, you progress. So I have all of that that I draw on. And then as a teenager, having grown up in this country and being made very aware of the colour of my skin, I think as a family, I have a huge family, we were keen to research some of that, see where you're coming from, where are our roots. And we trace that back to West Africa. So we are descendants of slaves taken from West Africa. So when I wanted to... put Black Voices together, I wanted to draw on every musical experience I'd had through my life. So we sing classical stuff, we sing jazz, we sing pop, we sing soul, we sing reggae. The fun part of what we do is that it's all a cappella, and it's all in the black oral tradition, so it allows us to never deliver a song the same twice, because it's very much about who's in front of you, how they're reacting to you, how you feel in that moment, whether we extend it, whether we shorten it because maybe somebody's got a cold. It's never done the same twice, and that's really important to us because it means that our music does evolve. So you may have seen us 10 years ago and then you see us now and you think, wow, didn't know they could get any better, but gosh, you know, it's a much more relaxed thing about the stage now. You're more confident about taking risk, whereas maybe in the beginning you played everything very safe.
And that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's a principle. It's a principle of a lot of different types of music, but certainly in jazz and in soul,
There
is that kind of fluidity, isn't there? That sort of improvisation.
Yes.
You know, you're sort of, the only rule is there are no rules. It's that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. There are some rules because, you know, you can't just make it up.
You know
what I mean? You've got to be in that moment. And I think some people think that people just do 500 runs and show off the beauty of their voice or whatever.
Mm.
Our group's not about that kind of thing. And if you're in front of us and feeling irritated by, you know, the frills and whatever that we're doing, I don't think we'd be delivering true to form. So, yeah, it very much is about what's the message. You know, you don't have to be a great singer to be in Black Voices, but you have to love singing. And there's a difference. I don't consider myself a great singer, but a lot of people come up to me after and say, wow, I wish I had your depth or whatever. And I'm just like, really?
So you mentioned that you were kind of, I suppose, around instruments or near music from a fairly young age.
Yeah.
So were you always singing? Did you find your voice at that time or did that come later? Because I guess a cappella music sort of requires you to step away a little from instruments, doesn't it, to an extent?
Oh, yeah, there's no instrumentation on stage for us. There's just percussion. But yes, as a child, we sang as a family. I mean, I'm from a family of 10 children, 6 brothers, you know, and 3 sisters. And my dad was a pretty handy guitarist. And we would sing as a family, you know. So, and you'd find your little groove on the table, tapping your beat or jigging or whatever and adding your harmony or adding a frill. You knew when it was good because everybody would be like, oh, let's go around again, you know. But if they didn't go around again, you know that you weren't hitting it tonight. I wouldn't say that I loved singing or thought that I would ever be a singer, but I did enjoy singing with other people, and I think those are great strengths that I call on even today in Black Voices. Just being with 5 other women on stage is so powerful. Everybody's voice is very different. That's a real strength of Black Voices. Whereas maybe when I was singing in the school choir, people were trying to iron out any creases in your voice to make you sound angelic like other people. Mm. And I hated that. I didn't understand why I needed to sound like everybody around me. Just let them carry on then.
It needs that kind of rough edge, that kind of character, doesn't
yes,
it, if you like. So I think you founded Black Voices in 1987.
Yes.
Which is a fair few years ago.
Yes.
And was that the point for you where that sort of, there's a number of things that you've mentioned, sort of ideas of perhaps identity and history. Is that the point where it sort of came to a head for you? You just thought, I have to do something, I have to be, perhaps, you know, I'm conscious of it, but I want to do more to explore.
Actually, I went to a performance in Liverpool. I think the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock from the States were touring, and we drove up from Birmingham. I was always a backing singer for pop bands and stuff, or did session singing in studio for pop groups that were recording albums. But we just wanted a bit more. Mm. You know, you get fiver at the end of the night, squash up in the back of the van with all the equipment to get home. No, that didn't.
It's not quite the showbiz lifestyle,
no,
is it, that really?
I was looking for. But we went to see Sweet Honey in Liverpool and didn't know what to expect. I'd never heard of them before. I just thought, Sweet Honey in the Rock, who are they? You know, let's go and have a look. And I went, and from the second song on, I was in tears the whole concert. I couldn't believe that five women on stage with a sign interpreter could make such an impact through the messages, through the harmonies, through the movement, through the rhythm, and I was just moved to tears. We came back to Birmingham and we said, gosh, we've got nothing like this in England. I think vaguely around that time, mint juleps had started, but quickly weren't there. Mm. And I think flying pickets were also on the scene. But there was nothing. There was nothing of five black women being on stage and just, you know, just the costumes they had and the elegance and the knowledge of the civil rights and the sharing of experience that shaped their music or formed their harmonies or brought the energy in what they did. It was just so captivating, and I thought, we need something like this here in the UK.
It's interesting you mentioned the flying pickets, because I think for a lot of people that's probably the example that they would give of a cappella singing, isn't
yes.
it? But it was very borrowed, wasn't it, in terms of, you know, it didn't really...
Yeah, but it was great.
It was,
I mean,
it was a good song.
At the time, yeah. It was great. They were offering something a bit different to what was in the charts, and so they stood out a bit. And they're still working in Germany, so, you know, they can't be doing too bad. but, yeah, at the time, that was the only reference point in terms of pure vocal groups. I mean, you've always had people like the King Singers.
And aside from Black Voices, the quintet, there is, I think, a number of things in terms of sort of education and outreach that that help, I suppose, not just underpin that, but help sort of, I suppose, give a bit more resonance to its message, would you say?
Yeah, I think because I was one of those kids at school that, you know, you'd audition for the choir, on a good day you'd get through, and another day you'd get the hand on the head, sit down, you don't quite fit, you know, you're too loud, Carol, or whatever. And those experiences scarred me a bit. And so it means as a performer now and as an educator of oral traditions, black oral traditions, I'm always keen for children to have expression, just to express, and not to feel that if you don't have an angelic sound that you don't fit, because we grew up feeling that, and I know what that feels like. So we do a lot of stuff where we develop music in school, develop singing programs in schools with children, that just allows them to express, if it's through poetry, if it's through hip-hop, if it's through grime, if it's through, you know, some kids do like to sing harmonies, they do like play songs from around the world, whatever, just get involved and let them feel that they're part of a bigger expression. That's so important.
There's something very satisfying, isn't there? Something very satisfying about singing, whether you can sing or not, there's something about that release, isn't there? You
and know, participating it's kind of, with others. Yeah.
It's like it's sort of letting off steam, isn't it?
It's
that, it's that kind of thing. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the concerts that you've done recently and some of the things that you've got coming up. Very excitingly recently, I think you opened for Beverly Knight.
Yes. Well, Beverly Knight, again, she's somebody we grew up listening to. Phenomenal vocalist. I know a lot of people will not thank me for this, but on that night, the songs that I really enjoyed of Beverly Knight were the ones she wrote herself, not the covers that she did, because it was the first time I'd seen her up close and personal and understood a lot of her life through the words that she had penned. And those were the moments that moved me most in her concert. But yeah, she's a great singer, and any cover, she could mash any cover from Here to Kingdom Come. She's such a phenomenal singer. And total respect for her. We're at Warwick Arts Centre on the 7th of March doing an Aretha show, celebrating the music of Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. That's The Queen Next Door, which is a really good title, I think. So where do we start with Aretha Franklin? Because she is a legend, nearly a goddess, I guess.
I think any black singer will have drawn on Aretha at some point. Everybody's got an Aretha song in their collection somewhere. You may not have her album, but you'll have, you know, whether she duetted with George Michael and you like George Michael, or whether she's duetted with everybody who's important, I think. Just a phenomenal vocal range, depth and breadth of music, catalogue that's just unbelievable. It's great fun to pick songs from her vast repertoire.
And her music has, I don't know how to describe it, but it has a kind of, I suppose, like a kind of turbocharged quality. Do you know, there's a moment where she starts singing and you think, okay, I know this song. And then something, someone presses a button or something and it, you know, it's all kind of possessive, isn't it? Yeah. You know, it's really
powerful.
Well,
I think she's turbocharged, but she's also very, not vulnerable, but she has really tender moments. You know, some songs you just think, oh gosh.
She's able to tap into it, isn't she?
Yeah. So I think she can sing anything. I mean, from gospel to jazz to blues to pop to... She can rock anything, you know. And, you know, those are the singers that have informed some of our repertoire and how we sing, because you emulate them as kids growing up. Yeah, we've got some phenomenal Arethas in our group. I'm not one of them, I'm afraid.
And also recently, I think you did a gig at the Jazz Cafe in London, celebrating Nina Simone's songbook.
Yeah, we've set up a few. It's like a series of performances that celebrate women who have influenced us. So from Mahalia Jackson to Miriam McCabe, Whitney, Aretha, Nina, Billie Holiday. Nina Simone is somebody that we opened for many times, and I think we were one of the last groups to open for her in Brighton on her last tour to the UK. So we have a special connection with her music and with her.
That must have been an amazing experience to sort of...
It's daunting.
I've read lots of things about Nina Simone, Dr. Nina Simone, I think she insists on or insisted on. I've heard that she could be quite forthright, shall we say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's no secret. People have seen it on film where she's told people within her concert to sit down, you know, when they get up to go to the loo or whatever. So, yeah, she's a formidable woman, but just an incredible musician and not a popular vocalist. A lot of people probably wouldn't pick her voice if they were looking for something enjoyable to listen to. But that's what I love about her. She was herself and she wasn't compromising her voice, her style, her message for anybody. And there's something, I think, that connects with black women around the world with that.
So just for folks listening, just to remind them, you're playing on the 7th of March at the Warwick Arts Centre.
Aretha, the queen next door, because she was a queen.
And you've also got something coming up in May, I think, on the 22nd?
We're at Birmingham Town Hall. So Black Voices is a Brummy group. We're all from Birmingham, born and bred. Really proud of our Brummy roots. And in our 30-odd years, we've travelled most of the world singing and giving concerts. 2 years ago, we decided that it would be nice to tell our story, the journey of Black Voices, through our songs. So we've worked with a French producer to create Black Voices, the show, and people have an opportunity to come and enjoy that at Birmingham Town Hall on the 22nd of May. So it'll be the first outing of our show, the show, in the UK, and it will be in our hometown at Town Hall.
Wow, real kind of homecoming gig.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So folks, I think, can go to blackvoices.co.uk.
Or blackvoicestheshow.com.
Oh, there are. A couple of choices. And you're on Facebook as well, I know that.
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram, all the usual. And yeah, we love hearing from people. I think that's what keeps us going. So when we got off stage on Friday night, all our social media blew up, and it's just nice to talk to people about how they found the show and, you know, what they want to hear next and all of that. So.
It's nice to know that they still come up and talk to you, but also share it more widely as well across the internet. Yeah. Well, Carol, it's been great to talk to you.
Yes, thank
and,
you.
And best of luck with the forthcoming shows.
Yes,
and
get your tickets.
We shall watch with interest what happens at the homecoming gig when you get there in May.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
More now from Vamis Theatre's Rachel Savage. The subject of this, I think, is as much about mental health as it is about the physical diagnosis of something terminal, I think.
I think you're right. I'm trying to think through the show and think about, you talked about the friendship and the unlikely characters within that friendship. Both of them have a similar reaction to their diagnosis. But I've talked to people who've talked about their reaction to it. So say, for example, one character, when he first arrives at the hospice, he doesn't want to be there. The doctors have told him, there's nothing more we can do, but we're going to refer you to the hospice. People hear the word hospice and think, how dare you? How dare you sign me off? I'm not going to the hospice, because people just go into the hospice and they leave in a box, and that's what the hospice does. And it's so wrong. I've been so shocked to find out what hospices are and what hospices do and how many years you can attend a hospice. And so one character within his mental state arrives at the hospice exactly like Nick did when he was thinking, I don't want to be here. But then he meets another character who's turned himself round into that feeling of, come on, live it, and let's live it together. And so it's that's the relationship of these two men who go on this death-defying adventure together. And it's all based on going into a second hospice, which was St. Richard's Hospice in Worcester, where I went to a men's space group. I arranged to go in and see if I can talk to a few blokes. And I arrived one Thursday morning and was introduced to 25 terminally ill men as today's speaker. And I just sat there and went, I'm not today's speaker. I'm just Rachel and I'm just wanting to chat to people. But, you know, they then go, well, no, you are today's speaker. Come on, what do you want to talk about?
So there's an expectation about the formality of things, I guess, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of sort of, particularly sort of clinical settings,
yep,
they reinforce that, don't they? I'm not sure they do it consciously, not always consciously, but they kind of squeeze out that human warm aspect sometimes.
Yeah, I think the research that I've been on, particularly with the two hospices that I've been working at, Mary Stevens in Stourbridge, was the first place that just blew me away, where I thought I was going to go into this hospice and it was going to be very sad and grey and gloomy and quiet and respectful, and I needed to be on my best behaviour. And I walk in and the radio's blasting out and there's nurses, sisters dancing, there's patients dancing, there's patients laughing and laughing and laughing, and they're ribbing each other, and the sense of humour is so kind of outrageous and dark. There feels like that clinicalness and that medical side of what you think hospitals and hospices should and would be about is just not there. And that's kind of the process that I've been on, that now it feels like our deaths are more medicalised. It feels like we live with an incredible NHS who the raison d'etre now is to keep people alive, just keep them alive. You know, we've got paramedics whose job is just to keep people alive, and actually maybe we're ready to die. And some people, if they are resuscitated, they're resuscitated in a way that their quality of life is so hideous and so upsetting for the family, that if they'd have just been allowed a natural, dignified death, how much better would that have been? And so it's also a conversation that I keep having about how medicalised, how clinicalised, or how natural we want this process to be. And I think that goes back to Maggie Keeble, who I had the original conversation with, and her saying, people need to plan, people need to take control of their end of life and say whether they want resuscitating. Where do they want to die? Do they want to die in a hospital? Why do you want to die in a hospital? Most people die in a hospital or a care home. Hospices are phenomenal places to die.
So let's talk a little bit about the process and the kind of and this production. So this is a co-production, I think, with the Corn Exchange Newbury.
Yep.
Okay, and the London International Mime Festival.
Yep.
And the Lech Trust.
The Lech Trust gave us some funding towards it. It's a co-production with the Corn Exchange in Newbury and a co-commission with the London International Mime Festival.
Okay, so from somebody coming forward saying, yep, your next production has to be based on this, it must be based on death, yep, death, dying and dignity and all those, yep, kind of different things. Yep. How do you extrapolate that? How do you take that and start to build it into the kind of the stage show? Because that's quite a process, isn't it?
It is. It's a journey that takes me about 2 years. And actually, nobody tells me what I have to make shows about. That's the brilliant thing. So the two collaborators kind of say, right, here's some money. And we work together in a way where they shout about our kudos, we shout about theirs. And then there's kind of so much trust involved that it's about, okay, go away, make the show, and I'll see you on opening night. The process has been, as I've talked about going into hospices, about working with palliative care staff and people needing the care of those people. It's also then I put the structure of a story together. Then I have associate artists that I work with where I send them the script. When I say script, it's kind of a mixture of research, interviews, ideas for scenes and an idea for a structure.
So it's kind of a scrapbook, I guess. Is that the way to describe
it? Yeah, within a Word document.
Okay.
And then we meet around the table and we drink lots of tea and have cake. And sometimes I come out of that meeting feeling a bit battered because people haven't said, "My Rachel, this is utterly amazing." They've gone, "Oh, there's too many scenes, Rach, and I don't like that character." And then we had an R&D rehearsal where I worked with different actors and then presented a kind of scratch performance to a whole invited audience of people that I wanted their opinion from.
So you're kind of, I guess at that point, you're sort of not testing things, but kind of refining things?
No, we're testing. No, we're definitely testing. Definitely at the testing time.
To just see what their reaction is, see how natural it feels, I suppose.
Yeah, and people to say, you know, you've got a catheter scene in here, and have we gone too far? Mm. And them going, oh my God, a taboo within a taboo, this is phenomenal, this will get people talking. Then I go back to the writing and I involve a whole production team, which is really exciting. So there's two teams, there's three actually, you've got your office team who make everything happen and book the whole tour and the whole kind of the foundation behind that. You've then got your actors and then you've got a production team, which is really exciting. So you've got people from a composer to a sound engineer to lighting designer, set designer, costume maker, props buyer and projection, as I've said, that we've used a lot in this. So it's a whole team. And one of my best skills is to surround myself with a team of brilliant people with fantastic skills.
So crucially, at what point then in all of that kind of flurry of activity, it's more than the flurry, it's a bit more a storm of activity. But at what point do the masks come in? So the folks that create the masks, are they sort of sketching, modelling it throughout that process? Are they coming up with ideas for things and then?
So I have to get the structure of the show.
Okay.
I knew Bob and Bernard were the central characters, so I know about them, and I write, I don't know, an A4 sheet on Bob and Bernard each, and I send that to Russell. Hmm. And then he sends me a few maquettes, which are tiny little, kind of the size of your fist, almost like they're little carved out pieces of clay.
Okay.
And he gives me a few options and I go, oh no, that's definitely not Bernard. He looks far too miserable. And he's good fun. I'll have that one, please. Or I might say, oh, Bob's nose is too big. Or can he be can he have more anxiety within his eyebrows? So those masks came back first. So we had those really early on in May time, which was brilliant. So we had those for the R&D in May. Then the rest of the characters turned up in August and they turn up in a box and it's one of the best pieces of post you can ever get. It's these kind of, you open up this box and I always go away and then I hide.
Nervously awaiting the courier, I guess.
Yeah. And I don't let anybody else in the office watch me open them because then they might go, oh, I don't like that, she's ugly, or oh, yeah. God, look at those eyebrows. I always make sure that I hide away because I know that what Russell's done is he has interpreted my character description and I have to take those out of the box and go, oh no, that's totally wrong. I said beautiful and sexy, and how is that sexy? I mean, we do have a laugh about, there's some masks behind me that I've said, can I have that one remade to be really beautiful and really, really sassy? And then they turn up in the post looking like Margaret Thatcher and I go, I don't know what your idea of sexy is, but it's very different to mine.
Have there been things that have turned up that you thought, you know, that your instant reaction is, oh no, that's not right, but then that perhaps, you know, you've gone away, had a cup of tea or something, come back and thought, well, actually, maybe it does fit?
Sometimes it doesn't work until you get it on the body of the actor.
Mm.
Yeah, I've had some masks going, oh no, it's never going to work. And then particularly James Greaves, I work with James Greaves and Alan Riley a lot. And James Greaves is an actor that's been, people who have seen our shows will have seen him time and time again. And he can just bring a mask to life.
And I guess the actors themselves kind of have to work with what they're given, I guess. They don't have an influence on the sort of design. I guess the
Not
internal
the design
part
of the mask,
it, I guess,
yeah.
maybe, but...
Yeah.
But the actual external sort of the character, if you like.
But that's also, that's my job to make sure that I cast the right actor that suits the right mask.
Let's talk about the current tour because it is a massively busy programme. And I think you're doing sort of, or you've started to do them, but 23 theatres in total.
Yep.
Which is a lot of theatres. And coming up, we've got the 26th of February in Shrewsbury, or Shrewsbury if you prefer, depending on...
Yeah, are we there for one night
26th
or
and 27th,
nights?
I think, for two nights. And then you're doing three shows in Wolverhampton on the 5th and the 6th of March. So a couple of evening shows and I think A matinee
on the 6th as well as an evening show.
Yeah, and you've already done, I think, you've already covered London, Edinburgh, Inverness, which Inverness, probably it's not the furthest point in the country, but it's a long, long old way from here.
Yeah, it is.
So what are the audience reactions been like in those sort of different venues?
Phenomenal, actually. It's always interesting when you go to London because you get the London International Wine Festival and that audience can sit there and cross their arms as if to say, impress me for the first 15 minutes until they start to giggle.
Are they an analytical crowd? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Whereas, you know, what we do is we tour all over the country. So it's you know, going to the remotest points as well as the city centres. It's like at Malvern recently, the reaction was phenomenal. And the same in Worcester, which are both our home venues, but we're finding wherever we go to, we get a very, very similar reaction of the roller coaster of what you expect on a good night out.
And very often,
you cry.
Very often, I think you do the kind of post-show aspect. So you kind of, and this is a really interesting thing for me when I came along to the Finding Joy show, was the kind of people being able to mingle with some of the characters, some of the actors, some of the kind of production team, you know, sort of being able to share more readily their connection to some of the aspects. I mean, a real kind of, you know, almost as part of the performance as the performance.
I think I'd drive the actors mad asking them to do that. But I really hold on to the fact that what we believe in is really engaging in our audience. And the shows and the themes of the shows and the way in which the audience invest and get taken along on that roller coaster is so deep, actually don't leave them there. Because what I think we need to do is, I think we need to take off our masks. I think we need to talk. I think we need to show our faces. I think we need to connect with them in an open way of, you know, this is me. This is Rachel. And when I say to the actors, right, you're going to take your masks off at the end of the show and you are going to speak, and I'll tell you different things I want you to talk about, I do not want an actor's voice. It's not an audition speech. I just want you to talk with your most down to earth, open, easy to connect with voice, and then you're going to go out into the foyer in your pyjamas or your dressing gown and talk for 20 minutes or have a post-show chat. And that's really because I think people want to talk about the show afterwards, and we've made people feel in a certain way and therefore have got a certain responsibility to go and listen to that.
Rachel, just finally, let's talk about trees, okay?
Oh, good.
And something that's very green. Not all trees are green, but a lot are.
Most of them.
Let's talk about Trees for Life, because consciously, I think Vamos is kind of supporting a kind of a rewilding of the Caledonian forest.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how you've been involved in
Well, we're just kind of taking our whole environmental policy onto another level where we just think, hang on a minute, come on, let's take some responsibility for the work that we do. So we're a touring theatre company. You know, we tour the length, the breadth of the country. Sometimes that doesn't feel great. And so we've made it a carbon neutral tour by working out the miles, working out what the carbon footprint for that would be, and then planting enough trees to be able to replace that. What we also have is a policy throughout the entire company where we recycle, reuse, and also talk about it and challenge each other on it. So we're always kind of thinking and feeling a sense of responsibility because we care.
I think that's a great thing because it's a very practical thing to be able to do. And lots of people talk about doing it, but you've very readily done it.
All of our publicity is on recycled paper. It's used vegetable ink. It's all of the merchandise that we've had made. So all the masks that we've had made is recyclable paper. We've had badges made at great expense out of bamboo or recycled plastic. I can't remember which one we went for, but it's a responsibility, which costs more money. But it's a bit like, well, put your money where your mouth is if that's what you're going to believe in. We'll be talking to the Arts Council, who are really interested in this initiative, to say, tell us how it goes, tell us how much it costs, tell us, because actually, as an NPO, a regularly funded organisation for the Arts Council, we need to be sharing our learning.
So folks interested in Vamos Theatre and all of the things that you've done, and crucially, the current run of Dead Good, I think they should go to www.vamostheatre.co.uk. Is that the right place to go?
That's exactly the right way to go. I would just say move quite quickly, because the venues that we've talked about, they sell out.
Okay.
Well, and we'd love to see you there.
We'll urge people to do that. But for now, Rachel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Rachel Savage and all at Vamos Theatre, Carol Pemberton MBE and Black Voices, M7PR, 448 Creative and Mac Birmingham. The new Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for Switch Radio.